You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Maggie is a troubled young woman who just wants to watch an old horror movie on streaming. Her aging Gen X uncle gets word of this and says, "No, no, no, you gotta watch it the best way, on old school DVD." But the disc ain't right, and horror ensues. That is the story of Dead Media, the world's first haunted DVD movie, and it is coming to cities across the U.S. this summer and fall. For tickets and full details, check out antennareleasing.com/films/deadmedia, because some folks may be done with the DVD, but it's not done with you.
Hey everybody, welcome to the New World Pictures Podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan, with me as always is Mark.
I'm so disappointed I didn't ask about the 1981 hit single Sex Dwarf.
And Erica.
Paul, I can attest, has a rad poster collection.
That he does. We
super jealous.
Yeah, we are talking to Paul Almond, right here in the middle of Ha Ha Gist. Rule of threes. And last week's episode, we talked about Beyond Therapy. This week, Paul Almond, he has spent so much time working for New World. He also worked for Live Entertainment. He worked for Warner Brothers Music. He was a lawyer with Corman's original lawyer, went to New World, stayed at New World once Corman sold it, and he was the executive for Beyond Therapy for the studio. So we're going to talk to him about that and so many more things. My gosh, do you want to hear about how they set up the deal for Roger's infamous Venice studio? We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about some of the deals for Cries and Whispers. We're going to go deep into not just the Roger Corman era, but also the second era.
And if you thought that our episode about Beyond Thunder was Beyond Thunder Dome, which will be coming out soon. That's another episode.
We haven't done it yet.
Sorry.
So you're like, wait, what?
Spoiler, Beyond Thunderdome is coming. Think of it as a pre-holiday gift from us.
Mm-hmm. What holiday, you may ask? I don't know when you're listening to this. Think about whatever holiday is coming in your life at the time you're listening to this, and it's a gift for that.
It could be a birthday party. It could be a birthday gift.
Right. It could be a retirement party. It could be a back-to-school gift. I don't know. Whatever it might be.
Just know that it's a gift from us. It's better than a gift card. You're going to be like, hey, I could have got a Home Depot gift card. Instead, I got an episode where our friends at the New World Pictures podcast talked about Beyond Thunderdome, a movie that wasn't even remotely close to being made by New World Pictures.
It's a gift. Paul is a great guest. You're going to love his stories. We are so grateful that he came on the podcast and talked to us about his long, long history. Plus, his posters that are around his office are not only for New World movies, but also his time at Live Entertainment. So we're going to dig into some of the movies he worked on during his time there. This is just chock full. This interview, you guys are lucky. All right, let's get into it. Here is our interview with Paul Almond.
I worked for Barbara Boyle's law firm. I was her first associate that she hired. It was my first job. And the law firm did music and film. Barbara did the film. There was a partner of theirs, of Barbara's, who did music. And I worked there. And then I left the firm to go to work for Warner Brothers Records. And I was business affairs at Warner Brothers Records because I had done music as well as film. Worked at Warner Brothers for a handful of years. And by the way, one of the great companies of the world, a guy named Mo Austin was the president. He recently passed away, but across the board, absolutely superb people. And I was in New York. Barbara called me up, said she and Roger had been talking. The company was expanding. And would I like to come work, head up business and legal affairs at New World? And I knew Roger a little bit. And obviously, I knew Barbara very well and loved the opportunity. Wanted to get back into the film business. Realized in the record business, totally different environment in the world of records back then as now. It's a totally different universe. And back then, the people that counted were the A&R people who found the talent and the promotional people who got you played on radio. Mm-hmm. Once you had that, you had the core of a company. And so I enjoyed it a lot, but I was hitting, I think, my late 20s at that point. And I also realized that, you know what? A, I was aging out of the music business, and B, While I enjoyed the music business a lot, and I was with the best record company in the world, I did like films more. So Barbara called me and said, "Would you like to come over here?" We talked for a while. I talked to Roger. Everybody got along very well, and so I agreed to come over. I told Warner Brothers, and they were hopefully sorry to see me go, and I was, but I didn't let it be out generally that I was leaving Warner Brothers. And I was back in New York 2 or 3 weeks later for Warner Brothers, and slowly the word was seeping out. I was getting calls from both the New York Warner Brothers people and the LA Warner Brothers people. "Paul, are you really leaving?" As soon as the word got out, three or four of the major record producers back in New York came up to me. I was using somebody's office back there and said, "Paul, we understand you're going to be leaving us to go into the film business. I had this script that I really love. Would you mind reading it? Because I really would love to see it made into a picture." I said, "Oh my God, it's already started, and I haven't even gotten there yet." So that was my entree to New World Pictures, and moved over to New World, which is at the time was on San Vicente, right across from the VA, if you know, guys know where that is, and proceeded to have a great time. We made some great movies, and I had some big successes and some lesser successes and a couple of failures. And then Harry Sloan and Larry Kupin, who were partners in a law firm, came, bid for the company, bought the company. And I, Roger Burley, they brought in Roger to run it. And Roger and I didn't, we didn't know each other. Roger and I hit it off right from the get-go. And Roger said, "Hey, you know, you seem like a great person to have run business affairs. Do you want to hold on doing that?" I said, "Sure, I love the company." So for the next 3 years, 4 years, I was at New World for a couple, 3 years, heading up business and legal affairs. And like every lawyer in a film company, at some point I'm saying, "You know what? I'm helping these guys who are the producers, solving their problems, taking care of their big issues. I should be a producer." So I got along with a guy named John Axelrod, who at the time was head of production. So John said, "Do you want to come over here, be a VP of production?" I said, "Sure." And then carried on for the next period of time as VP of production at New World, and then went off to various other companies, ITC and Live Productions, and held a variety of jobs at those kind of places. So that, in brief, is my history.
You said that you knew Roger a little bit before you joined the company. How did you know him at
I
all?
knew Roger because we represented Roger and New World before we all went over there. We were their attorneys, and as they made deals, they were a very small company at that point. It was a company, but you know, hardly what it became. So I knew Roger from that slightly. Barbara knew him very well because she represented Roger for years, and I knew Roger because on deals, as issues came up, I would talk to Roger and we'd go through things. So that's how I knew Roger.
And this is back when he was like making movies for AIP.
No, this was after AIP. He had actually formed his company. But it was, remember, he started out on a shoestring and really had this amazing ability to find talent that everybody knows about. Everybody knows who the talent is from Jack Nicholson onward and to Marty Scorsese and a host of others. And oh, should I tell you one very embarrassing story?
Please. Why
Of
not?
course you
We're here.
should, because I still shudder a million years later. There used to be a restaurant on Sunset Boulevard called Le Dome, and everybody ate there. And I would occasionally go over there to have lunch. And a host of these first-time directors, editors would come through my desk because none of them had lawyers, and I would do their agreement, and I would sit and explain to the various directors and editors and whatever what the agreement said and what they were getting, which was basically nothing. And so I was slightly friendly with almost all the people that came through the Corman School of Filmmaking. So I walk into Le Dome, and my person I was having lunch with was late. And so when you walked in, there was a big round table that people sat and waited for their guests to arrive. And so there's a fellow sitting there, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and it's a little bit obvious that neither of us quite remember the other person's name, but we know each other. So I'm sitting there desperately trying to make conversation. And so we talk back and forth in the most general terms. And I say, "So, what are you doing nowadays?" Hoping that that would get a response from him. And he said, "Well, Paul, I just have you seen The Terminator?" And I realized it was James Cameron. To this day, I still can't believe that happened. But so that's when
Also,
I didn't recognize him. I mean, I recognized him. I just didn't know exactly who he was.
you're right, sure.
At the time, I'm desperately trying to come up with a conversation that will get him to say, "Paul, I'm so and so, or I just did blah, blah, blah. I didn't mean it to come out. Paul, you don't know that I just did the Terminator?" I mean,
You start working at New World. Were you dealing at all with acquisitions, or were you just doing?
yeah, we in fact were, I think, I won't say we're the very first company to have made an acquisition, but it was John Bloom who called me from, and I don't remember which festival he was at, and said, "Paul, I've just seen there." And John was, amongst other things, he reviewed movies. And again, he was just a friend. That was the extent of what his interests were. But he called me up and said, "Paul, I just saw a really good picture." And I must say, I don't remember the name of it. This is now 30, 35 years later. "And you guys should take a look at it. It might be something you want to handle." And this is before anybody had an acquisition department. None of the studios did. Nobody did. And he sent the picture to us, and the salespeople all looked at it and said, "Yeah, it's a good picture. We could actually do something." So I made the deal for it, and we picked it up for no money at all. And while it was a really good picture, unfortunately, it didn't do particularly well. It did a couple dollars, but nothing big, huge. But as far as I know, and I wish I could remember the name of the picture and the exact date, that's the first acquisition that I knew of that any studio at the time was engaged in. I'm sure there have been other acquisitions by other places over the years, but that was the first real effort to hone in on a picture and say, "Yeah, we want it. Let's take it on."
Were you not involved at all with the foreign acquisitions?
Oh yeah, that too. Barbara was a little more involved than Barbara. You're going to be talking to Barbara Boyle, I assume.
I at some point, hopefully, yes.
Yeah, no, she's great. She just left UCLA after, God, 25 or 30 years at UCLA, after a very stellar career as a producer, and before that as as an attorney. But she liked those foreign pictures and really made a point of being very involved. So for the most part, the foreign pictures were her air, bailiwick, and I was involved in a couple of pictures. Barbara and I get along great, got along great then, still get along great, and we would divvy up and do everything, most things together. I remember I did the deal on Cries and Whispers, and that was quite a picture. And I remember sitting in the agent's office, and one of the big areas of dispute was that Roger wanted I believe, a presentation credit on it. And the agent, who was very precious, said, "Oh, we can't let anybody else's name be on the picture." But we insisted, as I recall, we did get the presentation credit. But yeah, Barbara was the Fellini picture she did totally herself. And so it was an exciting period of time. We were doing very well with pickups. We had a couple of very commercially successful pictures, not foreign art pictures, but commercially successful pictures. Don Knotts and, oh God, I don't remember the co-star, did
Tim Conway.
Tim
Tim
Conway.
Conway. You know better than I do. This is embarrassing. So they did a couple pictures for us, and
Private Eyes, and
yeah.
The Prize Fighter.
Okay, that's it. Interview over. I am chagrined. I am embarrassed. I am thrown up here. My God, my God.
I'm just trying
Don't
to.
be. We just talked about this a year ago.
Okay, well, my memory of this is 30, 35 years ago. I just
Don't
don't
feel bad.
remember. I can't remember now which of those it was, but I went back to spend a couple of days while they were shooting it in North Carolina, and they shot it at a huge mammoth estate. And I have never seen wasn't even a house. It was a multi-story, multi-room mansion on what had to be several square miles. And it was one of the great sets of all time that we're able to use. And it wasn't that expensive. So I remember being very impressed that the producer had found that location. But we did very well with those pictures at the time in current dollars. They might have been $100 million grossing pictures.
Wow.
They were huge films because at the time, before New World picked up, I think, Prizefighter first and then Private Eyes, they were making those yearly Christmas movies for Disney. And Disney shifted away from them. I think they're doing Apple Dumpling Gang and those kinds of movies together. Yeah. And then they shifted away and they did The Black Hole. And that's when that movie, Prizefighter, then was picked up by New World. And then they did their next film with them as well.
And we did the next film.
Private Eyes.
And yes. Did our very best to do a third film. But I think Don was getting a little bit ill at that point, and he just didn't feel capable of doing it, which was a shame because the two of them got along great. I think they really liked doing the pictures, and to have another picture doing the kind of gross that the first two would have been delightful, but it was just impossible to put together.
Now, to jog your memory a bit more, I read something about you having to go and fight a little bit for the Tin Drum because there was a lot of issues, particularly in Canada. They wouldn't release the movie because they wanted to censor it. Do you recall any of that?
I do. And I got to tell you, censorship rules. Have you seen the picture?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anything objectionable in it to you?
No, I don't think so. Like not in terms of like blood and gore or, you know.
Yeah. I mean, look, there were some strong themes in that. There were some scenes that were tough to watch, frankly, but it was certainly a creatively worthy picture. And with some really strong messages and a masterpiece, actually, I got to say. So we did have some disputes with various. Listen, we had disputes all over the place, and sometimes they helped us. One of the things we did, and I still remember it with delight, we made all of those pictures involving teachers or nurses and involved in sexually exploited situations. And we actually had one of the pictures, we had a group of nurses complain to us and were threatening to publicly boycott us. And I didn't like the idea of our being put down that way by a reputable group of nurses. And our sales guy said, "Are you kidding? If this gets out there, it's going to make this picture that much more attractive to everybody. Let them complain." So let them complain. And sure enough, it helped our box office. So what can I say? Strange things work sometimes.
Do you remember the movie they were working on when you first came to New World Pictures? Do you remember what was being worked on at that point? This is really jogging your memory.
Boy, if you gave me names, I'd say yay or nay, but I out of the blue, I can't come up with whatever was being, you know.
The Death Race 2000, somewhere around there?
Oh, Death Race 2000 was. No, that was one of our big hits. You know what the shame of Death Race 2000, and everybody always thought that. Roger made his pictures for what today would be the equivalent of $3 to $5 million. I mean, they were obviously far less back then, but... Mm-hmm. And the value he got, the production value he got for his money was astonishing. But all of us always thought if we had put doubled the budget, which Roger would never have done, but if we had doubled the budget and made that a more significant picture, we might have had a super smash on our hands and a series of sequels that would have changed our position in the industry. But it's just very tough. We had limited budgets. And if you've seen all, you must have seen all those pictures and you realize, for what they are, not bad, and sometimes very good, but imagine those pictures, the ones that worked with good concepts, beefed up, and what we might have done. So that was always hanging over our thought process on those pictures.
Yeah, and then he switches to do like sci-fi around the time of Star Wars. Did you ever go to the infamous Lumberyard, or?
I will tell you, has nobody told you the Lumberyard story?
We've heard a few, but I don't know. What's the Lumberyard story?
Okay, well, this is the accurate story because I was the one that did it. Nobody wanted to do it. Barbara didn't want to do it. There was nobody else to do it. And I guess I was low man on the totem pole. My job was to buy the Lumberyard and to get the approval of the Coastal Commission. The Coastal Commission, God only knows what it is today, but the Coastal Commission had authority over the ocean up to, I think, a mile or 2 miles into the coast. And therefore, they had to give final approval over any deal that was going to change what any business was going to do when they were sold or bought or whatever. So I not only had to make the deal for the lumber yard, which was actually the easiest part of the process, but could persuade the Coastal Commission that it was okay. We were really ecologically sound. We were not going to mess up the beaches and all of that. Well, in fact, what we were doing was really ecologically sound. We were going to change this lumber yard, which had dust and fumes and everything else going into the air as a result of their grinding and cutting up lumber, into a film studio, which is totally ecologically sound and was a huge improvement over the lumber yard. What none of us had counted on was the people of Venice. Now, today, as you know, Venice is a very glitzy, more and more upscale area and very expensive. At the time, it was, I certainly bought real estate there myself. Venice was a, not even blue collar. It might have been less than blue collar area. And all the people, all the neighborhood pressure groups were deathly afraid that with a studio coming in, we were going to upscale the property. And therefore increased their rents, which were rock bottom. And so I met with several of these pressure groups, neighborhood pressure groups, all of whom only had one concern. I mean, they claimed to be speaking in the name of ecology and good governance and all that kind of stuff. They were really just caring about what their rents were going to be. And so I met meeting after meeting, and I finally had the final meeting with them all. And I more or less put the deal together. And finally, we had just a couple of issues. I said, well, I've got to go back and get Roger Corman's approval on this, but I think we've got a deal. And with great delight, I went back to Roger, and I still remember the meeting with him. And I said, Roger, we've made the deal. All the local neighborhood groups are signing off on it. We're going to get our Coastal Commission approval to this, but there's one big condition. And by the way, this was accurate. There really was one big condition. And Roger's face gets a little bit long. And all right, Paul, what is it? Roger, they've made me agree that we will not improve the outside facade of the building at all, at any time. And Roger looks at me, said, wait a second, Paul. We can't paint. We can't improve. We can't put a new facade up there. We can't spend money on it. I said, Roger, that's the deal. He burst out laughing, I burst out laughing, and the deal concluded, obviously.
That is a fantastic story.
That had
story.
To be music to his ears.
I'm telling you, I made his week. I probably made his month.
There's a story, too, about that that is told by many people, but that they even had to keep this lumberyard sign.
Yes.
And that they offered to take it down, but it would have cost $200. So Roger just said, leave it up.
Not quite. That may be true. Actually, I haven't heard that. But the reason really we couldn't take it down was because that's the agreement we made. We weren't going to change the outside of that damn building at all. Mm-hmm. That was the deal.
Wow.
And the initial pressure on us, we were making a picture called Battle Beyond the Stars. Mm-hmm. And we had a co-production deal with, Mike Medavoy's company at the time.
Orion.
They were taking foreign. We were going to be the domestic distributors and the producers. And the deal with Orion was a good deal. And we all wanted to get that picture made. That was the picture that made Jamie Horner, if you know who he is.
Mm-hmm. The composer.
Academy Award winner, the Titanic. Mm-hmm. He recently passed away in a horrible plane accident, not recently, now it's a few years, but one of the great composers out there, and should not have been flying that damn plane. But anyway, so Jamie was the composer, did the score, and although there are all kinds of secrecy, NDAs involved, I guess 30, 40 years later, I can disclose that Jamie did the whole score, wrote it, hired the orchestra. It wasn't electronica, it was an actual orchestra. I think our fee was $35,000
or $40,000.
Wow. Never to be duplicated again.
Yeah.
But we had a date because of the Orion deal. We didn't have the ability to determine our own release date. We had to meet Orion's requirements for foreign, and they were already selling in foreign. So, and we had to shoot it at the studio, at the lumberyard. So the pressure was to get the darn deal done with the lumberyard, get the Coastal Commission approval, and start the picture so we could get it delivered on time. So that was the outside additional pressure to get the deal made. Otherwise, we could have, spent another 6 months fussing around with the deal. But we got it made on time. Picture got made on time. Jamie Corner delivered a great script, and all's good.
Yeah, and Roger used that score from James Horner again and again on many different movies and
Really?
trailers, and oh, he's used it so many times.
Really? Okay,
Yeah.
good.
He not only used the score, but he used actual footage on a movie called Space Raiders, which they did just several years after Battle Beyond the Stars, and it was re which was released by New World Pictures, but ultimately released by the new ownership group by Harry and Larry and Larry.
I vaguely recall. By the way, let me correct myself. I just realized the first picture that Jamie Horner did for us was Humanoids from the Deep. That
Yes.
was
Yeah.
$35,000. Second picture he did, and then he got paid a reasonable fee, was Battle Beyond the Stars. So Battle Beyond the Stars, he had full normal fees. Humanoids from the
And
Deep, which wasn't bad, was the first picture he ever did.
yes, the first one, and an interesting, beautiful score for a wild movie for Humanoids from the Deep, because it's
I don't know. I haven't talked to her in 30 or 25 years, but a woman named Marianne Fisher was Roger's.
assistant.
Have you dealt with her?
No, but she was her assistant, and then would she would go on to basically be an associate producer, I think, on Battle Beyond the
Yes,
Stars. So
yes. She was the fun. She gets the credit for finding Jamie Horner. He was teaching music at UCLA, and she had heard of him, tracked him down, listened to his music and said, "You're a composer," and that's what he always wanted to be, and come do Humanoids from the Deep. So if you, I have no idea how you'd find her, but she'd be a great person for you to interview you for you to interview.
I would definitely, I'm definitely will try to track her down. Around that time in 1979, actually in 1980, I was just curious about this because I think, weren't you responsible for the deal, the first video deal of New World Pictures, which was then to Warner's Home Video, which now I'm realizing you had, contacts at Warner's because you used to work there. But that was like the first time that New World got onto video.
Yes, it was. I think we may have released a couple of pictures on a one-off basis, but at that time, Warner's was just opening its video division. And a fellow named Carl DeSantis, who I later become almost best friends with because of that deal, Carl represented, they were out of New York, and Carl represented the new division, Warner's Home Video. And they were looking for titles to beef up their release schedule, and they came to us and said, "Okay, we have all the Warner pictures, obviously, but your pictures are of a different nature. They're more exploitive. We're going to attract a broader audience than the Warner pictures." And we made a deal that was, at the time, we thought it was the best deal in the world, and it turned out to be a pretty good deal. Not being the best deal in the world, because none of us had any idea how big the home video marketplace would become. But the numbers were good. It kept the company in solid profits for 2 or 3 years, and so all good. And we had a good relationship with Warner Brothers as a result. And a fellow named Carl DeSantis, who has passed away, was the attorney who I'd never met before, but we had that Warner Brothers background together. And as I say, he and I became very good friends for the next several decades.
Yeah, that was actually what made me think of it, because they released Humanoids from the Deep on video. So that's what made me think about Warner's Home Video. You said you really liked working at New World, and before we move on to the next phase of New World, I was just curious, what did you love about working at New World Pictures during the time that Roger worked there or
The
owned
people
it?
across the board. All great. Well, I won't say 100% great. People 90% across the board were great. And they were all, everybody just had a great attitude. And that nobody was there thinking, "Oh, is my name going to be in second or third position in the credits?" I mean, never had any of that. Everybody knew that they were working for a lower budgeted arena, that we were successful, that the pictures were going to get out there, and they got to show their chops. They got to show what they could do, and they were excited and they were happy. And They were proud of what they were doing. It was just a great group of people. Well, you've interviewed most of them, I'm sure. So you know what the kind of people they are. You know their level of enthusiasm. So how could you not like working with that group of people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a lot of young people, too, that were just starting out and getting their careers off the ground. And so Roger was very good at like handpicking people that were coming out of film school and were, you know, hungry for the opportunities. And
Roger had two great abilities, one of which everybody knows, and the other is a little more interesting in a way. Obviously, picking out talent from actors to directors. He had his favorite ideas about how to find a good director, which was to find a good editor. If you could edit, you could probably be a director. I mean, he was great. Everybody knew that. But here was Roger's fallback, and here was Roger's other great expertise. And he probably had many, but this one for sure. He could entrust a brand new director who had never directed before, give him a chunk of money and say, make the picture. Because he had the ability, if the director came back with a piece of crap, you know, 100 minutes of unintelligent junk, which, while it was rare, it did happen. Roger had the ability somehow to take those 100 minutes and edit them into a coherent picture that could be viewed and maybe not the best, but was still passable. Mm-hmm. And Roger was one of the great editors out there. And yeah, I've been around many an editor during that time period, after that time period. I don't know if there was anybody better than Roger when it came to that. So that was always the secret fallback, the secret sizzle, if you will, of Roger, because if his director totally screwed up, turned out not to be a director, Roger would figure out a way to save the picture.
Hmm. One thing that I've read that you said about him, though, is that he did love editors for sure, but he wasn't a big fan of writers. Is that true?
I'm not sure whether he said that or I said that.
I think you said that about him.
Oh, well, I won't say he wasn't a big fan of writers, but I hate to say this, and since I'm only represent a couple of writers now, hopefully they don't listen to your podcast. The group that most disappoints you in this business are writers. Actors, usually at their, I won't say their very worst, but if they're only mediocre in their performance, it's a decent performance. Directors, by the time you hire them, at least you're going to get something decent out of them. The writers are the one group that this doesn't refer to the top writers. The top writers are almost always delivered. Maybe not exactly what you want, but they deliver something well-written and good. An awful lot of scripts that you pay for and pay significant six figures. And this is me in my current or my production later years. And
that, sure.
You can get absolute crap from a writer. I just recently had a picture that we hired somebody. We did. I represent the producer who hired a writer. Academy Award nominee, credits on major pictures, and seemed enthusiastic. The producer got along with him, director got along with him, thought we were going to get a dynamite script. And the producer, knowing my background in production, would run things by me sometimes and say, Paul, I'm not commenting on this. Just tell me what you think. And I read it, and I almost in disbelief. And I called the producer up after I read it and said, this is a piece of crap. And he said, Dad, that's what we all think too. So it's unbelievable what writers can do. And the other problem is the Writers Guild, who are totally uncompromising. You cannot win if you have an action between a producer and a writer. The writer will win 100% of the time. Hmm. We had, and this is probably some of the history about why Roger felt the way he felt. We had a deal with a writer to write a screenplay based on an idea Roger had come up with. Roger, they drafted the script. I'd never read any of the scripts. Roger read the script, said, well, you know, I didn't really love this and this. It would have been better, this, this, and this. The writer, about a week later, without being asked, delivered another script, which Roger read. And Roger read that script and said, it's better, you know, it's not what I'm looking for, really. With Roger sort of shutting off any further progress with that writer, The writer then delivered, unasked and on their own, delivered two more scripts. And after Roger said, I don't like the direction we're going in, I think we shouldn't go forward. So we had the first script that arguably you could say he requested because he made some comments without asking that a new script be delivered. The writer delivered the script. And then without being asked and with being told pretty much that the script delivery time was over, redrafts were not being requested, delivered two more scripts. The writer then sued us for three drafts that they delivered. And we all went crazy saying we didn't ask for these. They showed up on Roger's doorstep almost literally. And we refused to pay for them saying we didn't ask for these. And we hired a very good litigation attorney who'd been before the Writers Guild. We lost in about half a day. Just kidding. So bottom line for producers, directors, whoever is employing a writer, just be very cautious and certainly don't expect you're going to win. If there's a suit, a guild disagreement, you're going to lose and the writer's going to win.
Speaking of Corman, did you also know Gene Corman as well?
Yeah, Gene was a good guy, not quite as prolific and not as well known, but Gene produced some big pictures and pretty much went the studio route where Roger was more entrepreneurial and opened up his own company and wanted to become another major. We were the major independent distributor for the years, both under the last years under Roger and the new years under Larry and Harry. Gene was more studio type guy. He liked the insulation that a studio creates, protects you from the world when you work for a studio.
That's interesting. That's two very different like points of view for two brothers.
Yeah, they got along well from what I could see. I didn't see them together that often, but I think there was a lot of brotherly goodwill between them and they liked and supported each other. But you're right, a totally different perspective on the world of filmmaking.
So when you do move on to the next group, you just stayed with the company, you liked it, you were enjoying the company. Was there a difference once you started with the new owners with Harry and Larry? And
Total difference. Harry and Larry were major lawyers representing television talent. And they were, I don't know if they were kingpins in the business because my bailiwick was films, not television. But from what I understand, from what I saw when I looked at their client list, maybe there were one or two firms that were bigger TV firms, but they were certainly in the top handful of TV firms in this city. And Harry and Larry, from day one, they wanted to make New World a big major player. And where Roger was happy building it up, they wanted to go overnight into being in the big time. They hired a head of production, or Roger hired the head of production, a guy named Don Borchers. And I don't know if you've interviewed him.
We have.
He is responsible, really, for the initial success of the company. He brought in three, four, or five pictures that just went through the roof. They were million-dollar pictures, and I don't remember the grosses anymore. But again, in current dollars, these had to be $50 million grossing pictures. One was called Angel.
Angel.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And have you guys ever seen it?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And the sequels.
And the sequels. You remember the tagline?
A schoolgirl by day, a hooker by night?
Guys, I could not walk into a party or gathering of people during that era and say it was some new world without somebody instantly giving that tagline. It was the most infamous tagline, I swear, of all time. And it was hilarious. I mean, it was just like, and then everybody smiled after saying it. And it just worked. It just absolutely worked. And we made a series of pictures that were just very, very good. There's another picture that Grace Jones started in.
Vamp.
And James Spader, his first starring role.
Tough Turf.
Great. And I remember Grace Jones in, it was either my office or Don's office. I don't remember whose office anymore, but was trying to show us the physicality that she had because the part, if you remember her role in the picture, was reasonably physical and a lot of movement and all of that. Mm-hmm. And she sat down on the floor, lay down on the floor, and did 15, 20 push-ups. And Don and I are looking at, did you hear this story?
No,
No.
no.
Oh, here's Grace Jones doing these push-ups. I can't do that many push-ups, and certainly not as well, even when I was 30, for God's sake. So she was amazing. So there was one other, loved Grace Jones, but she had one horrible feature. She would show up late, not by a few minutes past her call time, but by hours. So it was, did Don tell you this story?
I don't know if he told you this particular story. He did mention, though, that she would stay out very late. So she would keep very late hours.
I think 3, 4 in the morning was early to bed for her. So we started playing this, I didn't, Don and the producer playing this game with her, where we would set the call time like 2 hours early than the real call time, so that when she showed up 2 hours late, she was actually on time. After a couple of mornings, she realized what Don was doing, so she would then show up 3 hours late. So she was an hour late in reality. So then we realized what she was doing, so we would set the call time 4 hours. So this went on for the entire shoot. Nonstop problems, but we got it done. It was a really good picture. Everybody enjoyed it, and fun was had by all.
Yeah, I think he also he brought in Children of the Corn as well.
Children of the Corn. Did he tell you some of the production stories on that?
A little bit of it. And we also just recently we spoke to Fritz Kirsch, the director.
Oh, you know, we couldn't find any cornfields. I told you that
Yes.
story. Let me tell you the other story, which is similar. Back under Roger Corman's, remember the picture Piranha,
Oh, yes.
which we did Small Fortune. Well, guess what those damn piranhas don't do unless the circumstances are correct. They don't actually bite. They don't actually. Now, I know they do because I've seen those damn pictures in Brazil where they go after animals and stuff like that. But we got a bunch of piranha and put it into with meat and everything. We couldn't get the piranha to bite the meat, which we were gonna, obviously intersperse with the rest of the picture.
Sure.
And they had a, so they had to fake the whole thing. So it was a lesson about life with wild animals and outside. So nonstop, these are the worlds of production. Cornfields that you can't find, piranha that won't bite, and a host of others.
That's new world for you.
That's, well, that's actually everybody. That's
It's true. That's true.
dealing with
That's the
things that happen.
business. That's the
Yeah,
business.
that's the business.
But you were saying it is different being there and that they wanted to really accelerate the studio to be a much bigger company. How was it then on your day-to-day, like working for them under that environment? Was there more pressure? Was it more, were you everybody was desperately trying to find the next big movie? How was it in comparison to working for Roger?
Little more professional, little more suits and ties, slightly different group of agents and managers that we dealt with, but still an enjoyable experience. It, different, as I say, a little more buttoned down, but it's a film company. So, all film companies, if they're good in their essence, are looking for that creative spark. And Roger did, and Harry and Larry did.
Roger became president in 1984, but you had just met him just with New World, right? Because you guys worked together a little bit later together as well, right? At live.
Yes, I obviously either impressed Roger or he was whatever, but when he went over, took over live, he asked me to be his head of production. Prior to that, I had been ITC's head of acquisitions and co-financing deals, and we'd had some success there, and he sort of tracked me, and we slightly stayed in touch during that period of time, but he liked, I think he was most impressed with what I had done at New World. And asked me to head a production, and we had quite a successful run. And the only unfortunate thing actually was that we didn't find a big company that didn't also own Lionsgate to buy us.
Yes, because they're the ones that now own all that stuff, right?
Lionsgate, yeah. Funnily enough, Lionsgate, up till recently, was actually was a combination of New World's people and Live's people. The head of distribution at Lionsgate for years with the fellow was the fellow who had head of distribution at Live, and let's see who else. A lot of people came over from John Feltheimer
Yeah,
was back
let's
to
say.
New World.
He was New World Television, right?
He was New World Television. Yeah. So, yeah, there was a lot of, I mean, now it's a lot of years, so there's far fewer people that are in common. But yes, a lot of New World people and a lot of live people were over at,
Lionsgate. And John Feltheimer is still running Lionsgate.
John is trying to, presumably, I hear, has been trying to sell the company. And who knows, the rumor now is that with Comcast spinning off NBC Universal, NBC Universal will want to beef up their operation. They may be in the market for Lionsgate. So who knows? We'll find out.
Would you be in the market, do you think? You might buy it up, get all your stuff back, and get into the distribution game?
Or personally? Last time I looked at my checkbook, I would love to. I don't think I have the several billion dollars that are required.
Well, all right. I don't know. You can look under the couch cushions. You never know what you might find. But
that's true. I may have some wealthy clients. Who knows?
Now, you also dealt with deals at New World Pictures. Like, did you deal with like three picture deals for, say, directors, deals for talent?
Yes. And if you're asking me to recall which of those deals...
No, I'm just wondering if...
The answer is I don't remember. But yes, I mean, look, Roger had a great saying. If a director did their second picture for him, there was something wrong with the director, because he always felt that,
yeah.
You know, a talent's going to show with that first picture, and then they're going to be snapped up by a studio. And that happened often many, many a time. Mm-hmm. So we didn't make... Roger never tied anybody up. Should have, but didn't. At Harry and Larry's New World, we did make some multiple picture deals, and certainly at Live we did. You know, it's sometimes if it's a picture that's going to lend itself to sequels, or you're giving a director, for example, a major break, you want to say, hey, if we make a star of you and you become a star director, we want to have another couple pictures. You can still do pictures for other people, but we want to know you'll do another couple picture for us. I think during various periods in the film business, that's become either pretty much standard or very much something that nobody bothered with. Most of the deals that I'm making in private practice now, rarely, well, I'll tell you when you sign an actor to a multiple picture deal. That's when it's a picture which obviously is going to lend itself to sequels, and you want to know you've got the actor for the sequels. Then you'll almost always make a deal that requires them to commit to another couple, three pictures if you make the sequels. So the answer in brief is yes.
Well, it's top of mind because we did just talk to Fritz Kirsch, and he had a three picture deal. And I remember when we talked to Tom DeSimone, who directed Reform School Girls for New World, he had a three picture deal, though he didn't end up doing three movies for New World because New World had, you know, ran out of money, sold and everything else.
You know, I don't remember that, but if you if he said so, that must be the case.
Yeah, because he made Angel 3 after that, and then he was supposed to do a sequel to Wanted Dead or Alive.
Ah, okay. At that point, I think I was already in the production department. I was senior production.
Okay. So,
because I like I said, every lawyer who's reasonably bright in the legal side at a studio sits through this period where they say, I'm dealing with everything that a producer deals with. Why am I not producing? So I moved over to the production department and spent a year or 2 years in production over at Harry and Larry's New World.
Did you produce anything in particular?
Well, remember, when you work for a company, the production department doesn't produce. Its individuals don't produce. You look at projects. You try to find projects that make sense. You sell the company on the project, then you work to get it cast directly and get the producer to find the right director and get a budget everybody agrees in. So you're putting the pieces together. And finally, all alignment of the stars being correct, the picture gets a go from the studio and the actors stay involved and you send them off wherever the location is and the picture gets made. And with a little bit of luck, it's a good picture. It does some business.
Do you recall any project during that period that you worked on?
Actually, several. One of the pictures, and I, once again, this is why I didn't recognize, I recognized, but didn't remember the name of James Cameron. I don't remember anybody's name or the name of the pictures, but there was a picture that we did, this is back at Old New World, that had, oh God, it was a comedy based on a play that Chris Guest wrote. I'll be damned if I remember what it was. It was supposed to take place in New York.
It's Beyond Therapy.
Like I said, another embarrassing lapse of memory.
Christopher Durang play, and Christopher Guest was in it.
Yes, and we had an all-star cast, and it was a pretty good picture. At the time, the company was in a cash shortfall, so I remember Bob Ramey, who headed up the company. I was in Paris for the first week of the picture to make sure it all got going, and Bob called me after the first week and said, "Paul, we've got nothing going on here. We got to get some cash and raise some funds. If you want to stay there in Paris and just work on the picture, stay in Paris." So what I didn't do, had I realized how long I was going to be in Paris, I would have learned French, because I've always wanted to learn French, tried several times unsuccessfully. But had I known I was going to be there for a handful of months, I would have taken classes every morning and been surrounded by French-speaking people and learned the darn language. I didn't know that, and I didn't learn French. Still don't speak French. But we had a great time, great cast. Everybody had a great time, and it was it should have been a better picture, frankly. It just wasn't good enough. And also the other thing, Bob Altman, who directed it, swore to us, and by the way, great director, great person, but he swore to us that nobody was going to know that it was shot in Paris. Now, why he wanted to shoot in Paris, I don't recall. He insists that was one of the conditions, that we shoot it in Paris. Maybe he wanted to live in Paris for a few months, I don't know. And it was pretty obvious that it wasn't America. So I think that hurt it too. Mm-hmm. It would almost be better had we set it in Paris and said we were shooting, all took place in Paris, and we could have easily changed the script to make it appropriate for Paris, but we didn't. And, held it out as being an American shoot picture. And I think that hurt it as well, because you could tell.
Would Bob Altman have been a good director to sign up for a few picture deal probably at the time?
Oh, we weren't going to sign up Bob Altman. He was a big time director. In fact, the picture he made after, and I've always said, God, why couldn't he have made this picture for us? He made a picture about Hollywood.
The Player.
Great, funny picture. Worked well. Did huge box office business. Yeah. And so if our picture was a 5 or 6 on the Altman's schedule list of hits, misses, that picture was a 9 or a 10. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, we had the 5. His next picture was the 10.
But you got to spend some time in Paris, so you got that.
I got stuck in Paris, and I got to spend almost every evening with Bob, because the key crew and cast and people, there were always 8 or 10 of us at some fabulous French brasserie where we would have dinner and sit and say, this is Paris. This is what it's all about. So I had a good time. I hope I helped improve the picture. Had about 3 comments that I could make. Bob did not like comments. Bob, a director like Bob had his way of doing it. You weren't going to tell Bob what to do. But it wasn't a bad picture. It just didn't totally click. And as I say, we did okay with it. Nothing great.
What was it like working with Bob, though, outside of going to French cafes and stuff?
I enjoyed working with him because we talked film stuff all the time. And so we would talk about what pictures were working, what pictures weren't, and why he was doing certain things. So, he was one of the great old directors in this town. So it was a fabulous experience for me. I mean, basically, when you hire a director for a picture, you talk to him a couple of times, you get his take on the script, and not much more than that. With Bob, since he and I and others were there in Paris for months, I won't say I established a good relationship, because the day after the picture ended, I doubt, he was inviting me over for dinner. But while the picture was being shot and we were a little bit of post, it was a great experience working with him.
This was one of the movies that you were in working on. Do you remember another one?
Give me some names during that period and I'll let you know.
Let's see, right around that time. So we're talking 1985. That's Transylvania 65,000.
Oh, God, the tragedy of that story. The picture, we all love the script. And the producer was a major league producer and got us as the star. Do you know the name of the person he wanted as the star?
No.
He didn't want Jeff Goldblum or Ed Begley Jr.?
His first choice, who said yes, that we got. All right, who's the most prestigious name as an actor in their 70s out there?
Burt Reynolds?
Who?
Burt Reynolds?
No, alive, active. Today. Oh, alive. If you want to go picture? Okay. You
get this guy. I thought you meant the
not 1970s. From the 70s.
I thought you meant the 1970s.
No, today. Who's,
A comedic actor, I would assume, right?
No, not that. Well, partially comedic, has played every role in the world. Come on, if you want to go picture.
Harrison Ford? I think he's 80 so now.
It may be bigger and better than Harrison Ford.
God, he's 70 years old. God, you're stumping us. You're stumping us, Paul.
Yeah. Now we can't remember names.
So far, you've impressed me.
Sorry. This is where we completely ruined your
I'll give you a TV title.
Oh, okay.
Bosom Buddies.
Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks. Yeah.
Tom Hanks. And Mace Newfield, who produced the picture, came to us with Tom Hanks, said this kid's a genius, hit TV show, he should star in it. And we said no. And I won't identify the guilty parties who said no. Just know I was not one of them. and we Fair said enough. No. And I think Mace never forgave the company for that, ever.
Because he never did another movie with New World.
Nope.
Yeah.
At least not that I remember.
Wow.
Was that before Splash or was that after Splash?
Oh,
after.
Before Splash. No.
Was it? It was right about to happen for him.
See, you stumped me because Tom Hanks is timeless in my mind. He's ageless.
Tom Hanks is what?
He's ageless in my mind. I don't think of him as being 70.
He is ageless. I mean, look at I can't think of a bad picture.
Yeah.
He's ever made. I can't think of a picture I haven't enjoyed that he's ever made. They go from good to great.
Mm-hmm. So, maybe Polar Express, but you know.
Okay. I remember that. Okay, with one exception.
Did you left New World to go to ITC? But were you just ready to leave New World? Was it around the time that things were kind of falling apart for New World? What led to
things
the decision?
Were getting slower and ITC was an exciting opportunity. ITC needed me because they had one of the more fabulous TV libraries in the business. They were the old Lord Lou Grade's company, if you recall.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they're a British company, right? Library. Originally?
Excuse me?
They were a British company, right? ITC Entertainment?
They still were to the end of British. Mm-hmm. And the problem was, and they were at that time, they were one of the bigger, they claimed to be, and who knows whether true or not, but they claimed to be the biggest supplier of short form TV movies, other than ongoing series. They were the biggest supplier of features and other short form productions into the TV industry. We had a fabulous TV business. But they were trying to make deals all over the world, and they had a library. They had a few current projects, but they had a library that was fairly aged. And so they needed two or three theatricals a year of some significance, and that they could help sell the entire, whatever was the then current list of projects. So my job was to get them into the film business. So I made a picture called Zandalay. I made a picture with Drew Barrymore, a horror picture, which is escaping, the name of which is escaping me. We had some good stars, some good names, and we were successful in what we were doing. And I was there about 3 or 4 years, and that's when Roger called me and said, hey, I'm about working for a real film company. Come over to Live Entertainment, which I jumped at, frankly, because it was a exciting company. I knew Roger was going to make a success of it. And we were the biggest non-studio theatrical producer, production company, distributor in the business during the time I was there.
The name of the picture is Doppelganger.
See, you know what? I'm taking your name. I'm taking your number. And whenever I have a question about my past, I'm calling you. You're way better than I am.
Well,
you remember the name of my grandparents.
I did fail you on Tom Hanks.
You did fail me on Tom Hanks. Let me tell you one story about Doppelganger, because this is, I swear, you know, pictures germinate for 10, 15 years. I have clients right now. One of my clients, she's just gotten a picture going that she's been in development on for literally 15 years, drafting, wow. Draft,
wow.
Almost setting it up with one star or another, and just finally, it looks like it might be happening. The exact reverse happened on Doppelganger. I knew the director socially, an Israeli guy who was over here for a couple, 3 years for some reason. And he said, one day he calls me up and says, I've got a pretty good script that I wrote. It's a horror script, and I think I can get Drew Barrymore to star in it. And I said, okay, if you can get Drew, and it's, I love the script, thinking, yeah, right, I'll give it a go. So he sends the script over, and I had nothing doing that afternoon. He sent it over about 2-3 o'clock. So I read the first couple pages, thinking I'll put it down and read it maybe over the weekend. And I liked the first couple pages, so I kept on reading. I read the damn script over the next hour. I called him up about an hour and a half after I got the script and said, you deliver Drew, we've got a picture. And we talked about the budget. He said, I've got Drew, and son of a gun, the picture came out, succeeded, and the fastest I've ever heard of a picture getting made from the time of first pitching.
Wow.
Certainly from your career, but in many people's careers, that just doesn't happen that quickly.
I have never, either as a in-house production person, an in-house lawyer, or a attorney in private practice, I have never known of a situation operate that quickly.
Yeah. So I'm
sort of proud. I may or may not hold the record, but I certainly I'm tied for the record.
I would hand it to you for sure. When you go to Live, were there projects that you remember that you were particularly proud of when you were at Live? Because you were there for a good.
All the pictures. I was proud of every picture. Wow. In fact, here, I'll. This is my office, and I'm going to turn the screen around and show you some of the posters. Now, I don't know if you can see these or not. You're picking these up. Let me know.
Oh, yes.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
And you have girls just want to have fun.
That was a damn good picture. That picture, I think it did okay, but it should have done really well, really well. And it didn't for whatever reason. But the pictures, okay, what are the pictures I'm proudest of? Wishmaster did exceptionally well. In fact, I just rewatched it. It was on some streamer and I couldn't resist watching it again. And I realized all the problems that I remembered from a million years ago still existed in it. Had we been a little bit tougher and given them a couple more dollars, I think it might have really done well. As it was, it resulted in about 3 or 4 sequels. The picture that, again, should have been a hit, and I've never known why it wasn't, it was The Substitute, the Tom Berenger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I remember we had I remember going down, we shot it in Miami. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Miami in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
You do not want to be in Miami.
Miserable.
This is when I realized that actors were different creatures. They're not human beings. They are a different species of humans. I'm sitting there standing still in the shade, watching them shoot this. I am dripping sweat. Everybody's dripping sweat around me. And Tom and 3 or 4 actors are in a scene. They're physically active. They're not being protected by an umbrella or anything. They're out in the damn sun and humidity. Not a drop of sweat doesn't slow them down. And I'm looking at them and saying, my God, this is unbelievable. These are not human beings. These are a superior species to be able to do this. And I've always been impressed with what actors can do. That was as impressive as I can imagine. Great, great group down there. Really enjoyed that. And I actually spent a night or two in South Beach and absorbed a little bit of the Cuban culture and had a great time. But it was a good picture, very proud of it. That, even though we didn't go through the roof, I think again we had three or four sequels on that.
Yeah, right. I
It was
was
a
about to
very
say it
strong
did get
picture.
sequels. Yeah.
Yeah.
One that came out in that time, a period which has got nothing to do with anything, but I just would say since you it was your from your company, but I always loved Critical Care. I thought that was a really, really good movie. I mean, Sidney Lumet, I
Oh,
mean, I
you're hitting a sore spot. You are
oh
hitting a
no.
nerve.
Uh-oh.
Why is that?
First of all, you know who the director was. Another
Yeah.
test.
Sidney Lumet.
Sidney Lumet was one of those magical names that almost made it, never made a bad picture. And it wasn't a bad picture,
It wasn't.
but it just was different than what we all expected. And the marketing department didn't know what to do with it.
Sure.
I mean, and we just never found an audience for it. I always thought it deserved better than it got. The reviews were mixed, as you may or may not recall. And we worked and worked in post, and I don't know. It's of all the pictures that I was in charge of and responsible for, that was my biggest disappointment. Not the picture, but the lack of commercial success.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I can see why it was sold as a big comedy because, I mean, Albert Brooks plays a
Oh.
camp, you know, he's in it. And I mean, it has a lot of comedic moments, but it's also very serious. So it was hard to.
That was probably one of the problems with it, that it was a combination of both. Sydney never got quite the right tone to it. That worked. I mean, look, when you look at Sidney's body of work, my God, one of the great American directors of all time. And this one, again, I enjoyed it. I thought it was good, but it didn't satisfy an audience, unfortunately.
But you do have a poster up of Tree's Lounge, which is another terrific movie.
Tree's Lounge, I gotta say, was made during a different era. Couldn't have done what they did. I'm looking at the dailies. And Steve Buscemi was great. I haven't talked to Steve in a million years, but this was Steve's project, and I doubt he's changed. He was one of the great guys, unassuming, straightforward, no BS, no star thing going on, just a good guy that you could talk to and speak about things. So one of the scenes that's being shot that I'm watching on dailies, by the way, an extremely low budget picture. So I'm watching the dailies, and there's a scene where they're jumping in and out of a subway. This is shot back in New York. And I remember the next day, I don't remember whether I was talking to Steve or to the producer, and knowing the budget, I said, "How in the world did you get that subway shot? I mean, you had to shut down the tracks, you had to do a deal to get the use of the subway." And there was a long pause and said, "Paul, don't ever repeat this. We didn't have a permit. We didn't do anything. That was all live action. We jumped in and out of a moving subway several times to get the shot, and we didn't get anybody say so to do it." I said,
Wow.
"Thank God you didn't tell me till after it was all done. I don't want to know this." And if our insurance company had known, they would have probably canceled the damn insurance. That was a different era. That was the time when people still did that. I haven't known of anybody doing that lately.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, it's a great film. I'm kind of always surprised he hasn't directed more.
I am too, because it was a good film and we did fine with it, and he has ability. Now, maybe he's too busy acting, and he's a family guy. I mean, he's got a lot of interest in this life, and so maybe he just isn't. Look, to be a successful director, I know one thing for sure, having dealt with successful directors. You're looking at Martin Scorsese's first attorney, by the way. Had I only known, I might have never left private practice and stayed representing him. But you've got to be driven. It's got to be your reason for existing. Every successful major director I know, that is their reason for being. That's why they're here on earth. And Steve wasn't that way. Steve was happy to direct that picture. I don't think he was driven to become a director as a career.
Since you brought it up, Martin Scorsese, were you his lawyer during Boxcar Bertha?
No, he did that for Live when I was not New Live. He did that for New World.
New World, yeah. Well, for Roger, it was released by, it wasn't released by New World Pictures, but
No, I think it was released
Roger,
by IP, wasn't it?
I think so, but Roger produced it. Yeah.
Roger produced it. You can't represent both sides of the same transaction, so I couldn't represent Roger and Marty. No, but like I said, every director from Jim Cameron to Martin Scorsese, after they did their first couple pictures for Roger, they would know me a little bit. And Marty knew me, and he made Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And yes, and at that point, I can't even remember. Maybe I still worked for New World at that point. Maybe I was, I, God, all these dates are flowing together. But anyways, he asked me to represent him. And I remember doing the deal with Warner Brothers, and I remember that was a huge battle because the female lead of the picture, who's the star of the picture, was. She was doubtful about whether Marty should direct a picture that she was going to star in because everybody knew Marty was a guy who directed guys. He directed gangster pictures, he directed action, pictures that were gritty. He knew how to deal with any male in the world. But she fought, and therefore Warner Brothers was on the edge about what to do. She, for a long time, wouldn't agree to let him direct. And finally, she gave in. And of course, okay, you tell me what happened.
She won Academy Awards, Ellen Burstyn, right? So
Yep. The biggest irony of all time. So, why he didn't direct more pictures with leading women, with featuring women as leads, I don't know. But he obviously showed he could do that equally well to the De Niros of the world.
This is great, and I know that it's getting late, so I don't want to keep holding you up, but I just have a couple of ending questions for you.
Sure.
Because we've been talking about Roger, he passed away a few years ago. When you think back and you just think of Roger, what is the memory that stands out the most to
Sheer intelligence.
you?
More even than filmmaking ability. I shouldn't say more than, but as much as he was a filmmaker, he was an incredibly bright guy and could analyze anything, whether politics or construction issues. He was just an incredibly bright human being. So that's my memory of Roger. I
Yeah.
wish he was still with us.
Us too. Us too. That's why we're trying to talk to everybody now, because that sort of taught us like we can't wait. We can't
No, you
say
can't.
you can't.
There's another woman who has passed away just recently who you should have interviewed, Frances Dole.
Yeah, I wish we could talk to Frances Dole, yes, who was with him forever and spun
Forever
missed
and
her.
worked with every writer he ever hired
Right.
and was probably in many ways the key production person, whoever had that title of head of production. Frances was the person who wielded more power and respect than anybody else that Roger worked with in the creative area.
Yeah.
Okay, I look at I've got to run, you've got to run, but one
Yeah.
quick Frances Dole story.
Please,
She was
please.
English. A genius. She was absolutely a genius. And I think she went to Cambridge. And we're sitting there talking. We'd gone to some lunch or something, and Michael York was there, and they knew each other from school, and they talked a little bit. And afterwards, Frances and I are talking about schools. And now this is a woman, assuming it was Cambridge that she graduated from, and not the reverse of what the story I'm about to tell you. And she, huge success. Certainly, had she wanted to go out into the wider world beyond Roger's world, she would have. I think she actually did end up in some creative job at one or two studios for a while, came back to Roger. And we were talking about some of the things that had misfired in a career, in our careers. And she said, Paul, Cambridge, where I studied English, they call it, I don't know. There's a word they use. I studied English at Cambridge, and she got, of course, the highest honors. Said, Oxford had a better English department. I wish I had gone there. And I'm saying, Francis, you graduated one of the absolute great schools of the world, and you did extremely well there. How can you not just enjoy the fact that you went there, had a huge successful career coming from that school? She said, yeah, but the other one had a slightly better English department, Paul. So it was just very funny. She was that kind of person. Yeah, it's a shame we weren't able to interview her.
Yeah, absolutely. Very much a shame. If I can ask you one last question, because you were there for the end, the Harry and Larry years of New World Pictures, and you got out there before, I think, the very end. We've talked to some people that were there literally working the last day, you know, that they were around. So we've talked to a variety of people, but did you sense that things were going a bad direction for New World Pictures, or that they were maybe going to?
No, I can't say I sensed that. They clearly, look at, they went for some big mergers and big co-production opportunities, and they didn't quite pull them off, came very, very close. And I think it was, I'll tell you what was clear to me, that Harry and Larry wanted to sell the company. I'll tell you, okay, this, can we end it with this one Harry story?
Yes.
I don't know you'll ever get to interview Harry. Have you tried?
Not Harry yet, but we will try.
Try. All right. When Harry and Larry took over the company, I had thought that the financing was going to be mammoth. I thought, here are two guys, they have billionaire friends. We're going to have a few hundred million dollars to play with. And then I found out the amount of money, which was still multiples of millions, but not the billions that I expected. And Harry, I thought, and Larry were a little bit naive about the film business. They didn't really understand it. And I was the guy, Roger was obviously one of the guys, but I was the other guy who knew the film business. I remember walking into Harry's office saying, Harry, I want you to realize this is a really expensive business. It's not just producing the pictures and paying for the cost of production. It's the marketing cost, the overhead we're going to have with 100 employees in half a second. We need a lot of money to keep this operation going. Do you realize what you're going to require and the risks you're taking? Why I took it upon myself to have that conversation with Harry, I have no idea, but I did. And Harry looked me in the eyes and said, Paul, listen, I do realize the risk. I want you to know, I started my law firm several years ago and built it into one of the biggest law firms in the city. The worst case is I don't succeed and things fall apart here. I've always been successful. I'll go out and start another law firm. I'll find another business to buy. I said, Harry, you know what? You're right. You will do that. He had total faith in his own abilities, correctly so. And I've always remembered that Harry was the absolute optimist. The joke around the office was he never met a deal he didn't want to make. And he had total confidence in his own abilities. And he was going to succeed and did succeed at whatever he did. And he, as a result, New World under Harry and Larry, as I say, became the biggest independent film company in the country. So that's my story.
And that's it. That's our interview with Paul Almond. Again, many thanks to Paul for coming on the show and talking to us about his long history at New World. I feel like we just scratched the surface. I'm not going to lie.
Absolutely. And I gotta give him a lot of kudos. Gotta give him his flowers. Obviously, this is a podcast and you didn't get to see it, but it appeared that Paul was talking with us from his office.
He was, yeah.
And you know how, at the end of the day, you just want to get up and get the fuck out.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. He stayed and had a long chat with us. And mm-hmm. I am incredibly appreciative of that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed late at the office to talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
We're just so grateful to him. Just for us and for you,
mm-hmm.
dear
mm-hmm.
listeners. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you want to listen to our episode about Beyond Therapy because you missed it, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can find all of our interviews, episodes, articles, t-shirts. That's right. We have t-shirts. Go ahead and buy one. It helps support the show. You could also tell your friends about the show, write us a 5-star review. All those things can help us out. If you want to get more of these free episodes, like the one day, maybe Beyond Thunderdome episode.
Oh, it's coming.
Have promised, and I don't know how we will deliver on. In any case, you'll have to find out by continuing to listen to us at the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network, please select the link in the description.
Are you a film fan who loves the ultimate home video experience? Look no further than The Disconnected. Your host, Ryan Verrill, is your go-to source for the latest and most accurate information on home video releases, exclusive interviews with industry insiders and filmmakers, and has established a thriving community where every film and physical media enthusiast feels welcome. From hidden gems to blockbuster hits, The Disconnected brings you insider knowledge and a welcoming space to share your love of cinema. Watch every Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific for the live announcements show and follow The Disconnected on social media to stay updated. Subscribe to The Disconnected on YouTube or on the podcast provider of your choice and dive into a world where every movie night is an adventure.